Good evening, listeners. It is the 15th of April, 2018, and you're tuned in to 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lori Lutz.
And I'm Scott Classic. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and the personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or if you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, you can check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our upcoming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages. We also have a podcast available on iTunes now, so you can search for Inspiration Dissemination and look for the orange light bulb logo.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests, and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we are joined by Brian Erickson.
So, Brian, welcome.
Thank you.
And can you just get us started off by telling us a little bit about the work you do?
Sure thing. So the project I'm currently working on looks at a common and often implicit assumption, which is that knowledge of environmental problems leads people to want to take action on those environmental problems. And so the project I'm working on is looking at curriculum and teaching students about ocean acidification to sort of examine some of that those assumptions.
Okay, so social science basically with a background, or I mean, about talking about, you know, environmental science problems. So,
So looking with a social science lens at how we talk about natural science problems.
So you mentioned ocean acidification. Now for some of our listeners might be familiar with what it is. Can you give us a little bit of a background on that for those who might not?
Yeah, absolutely. So ocean acidification is the change in ocean chemistry that results when carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean. So basically, we as humans release a bunch of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere with our daily actions, burning fossil fuels, deforestation, cement production, that kind of stuff. And it doesn't just stay in the atmosphere. About a third to a quarter of all of the carbon dioxide we produce gets absorbed by the ocean. And when it does, a series of chemical reactions happens. It lowers the pH, making it more acidic. And it also gets rid of, or it reduces the amount of this thing called carbonate, which a whole bunch of animals use to build shells and skeletons.
Yeah, so like oysters, corals build skeletons as well.
Exactly.
I think some types of algae even do, have like calcite skeletons.
Yep.
So basically that could impact a bunch of different groups of organisms living in the ocean, and we're not very certain how they would change to an increasingly acidifying ocean.
Yeah, so we know that the ocean is acidifying, and we know how organisms react in laboratory settings, but taking all of these different responses, so some of those responses vary depending on which species you're looking at or where you're looking at them. And so extrapolating to try to predict the future of an entire ecosystem or multiple ocean ecosystems starts to become much more difficult. So we know that ocean acidification is happening. It's likely to get worse. It will certainly have impacts on ecosystems and on people who rely on the ocean. But we are trying to figure out more about what those specific impacts will be and which people might be impacted first.
So can you just give us a few common examples of the effects of ocean acidification, both in the ocean and, as you mentioned, some effects on humans?
Yeah, what might happen?
Absolutely.
Or so, what is happening?
Yeah.
So one way that we found out that ocean acidification is a now problem as opposed to a future problem actually happened right here in Oregon. So outside of Tillamook, there's a small shellfish hatchery called Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery. And in the mid-2000s, they've been in business for 30, 40 years at least, providing about 70% of all oyster growers with baby oysters. And in the mid-2000s, suddenly all of their baby oysters were dying. And we're not just talking about some, we're talking about most, if not like 80 to 90% of their larvae died. And for a few years, they couldn't figure it out. They reached out to Oregon State scientists, It still took a couple more years, and so eventually what we realized is all these baby oysters were dying off because they were spending too much energy way early in their life trying to build their shells, and essentially they ran out of energy before they could start feeding. It's kind of like your phone runs out of energy before you can plug it into the wall. A lot
of... Sounds like a serious problem.
Absolutely. So a lot of larvae can die from ocean acidification, some shells. So we know that corals have a harder time building coral reefs, which has all sorts of impacts for fish and animals that live on coral reefs. Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest, about 30% of all animals use carbonate, that thing that I was talking about earlier that starts to disappear. So there's a whole bunch of animals that potentially could have a harder time getting by.
Interesting. Just for any listeners who might be curious to hear more about this subject, especially Whiskey Creek, the oyster hatchery and the die-offs and the calcium carbonate, we did an interview a couple months back with Sophie Wensman, who talked about how oysters might be kind of stressed out and what the chemistry of that situation looks like. So you can check that out. Anyway. Yeah.
Sophie's doing really exciting work, and she's doing it at the Shellfish Hatchery in Neatarts Bay.
Very cool.
Very cool. So now that we have a little bit of a basic understanding of ocean acidification, your research was actually working with curriculum for mm-hmm. high school students. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I'm a former high school science teacher. And what we were trying to do is look at the ocean acidification curriculum that's already out there, try to add some improvements, and then go out into classrooms out on the coast and actually teach. So in addition to building a new curriculum, we also ran an experiment where we sort of taught students for 3 days the general story of ocean acidification, what it is, the chemistry behind it, some of the impacts. And then on that last day, we actually split our classrooms into two different groups. Half of all of our students did a normal lab that's typically done, and half the students, we talked about possible solutions, actions that kids could take in their households or in their families that would reduce their energy use and thus reduce how much CO2 they were producing.
So you were kind of looking at different, like a more traditional approach to teaching this sort of curriculum and seeing how maybe you can have a greater impact on the students, a more long-lasting impact on them.
Yeah, we were looking at having an impact and also that question of, well, does learning about this environmental problem make you want to do something about it? And do you even know what you could do about it?
So what were the solutions that you posed, I guess, the actionable steps you could take to mitigate your carbon dioxide footprint that you presented to the students?
So the solutions we presented come from a paper, I think, from 2008 or 2009 called The Shortlist. And basically what it does is it looks through all of these possible actions you could do, everything from reducing your meat intake to turning off the lights to insulating your home. And they basically narrow it down to a series of actions that are low cost, high impact, and save a lot of energy. So the things we ultimately ended up talking about were everything from insulating your home, replacing windows so they're more efficient, getting a more efficient car. And that's not an electric car or something like that. It's a car that just gets 10 miles per gallon more. So some efficiency improvements there. We looked at some common misconceptions like turning off the lights or planting a tree, things that people think of when they think of environmentally friendly actions, but they have less of an impact than some of those other actions in sort of a CO2 basis.
And you mentioned a couple other things like, you know, just the habits that you take when you learn how to drive, for example, like since they were high school students, you know, just making sure that they don't just hit the gas and then hit the brake, you know, that could potentially add up, right?
Yeah, I totally forgot that was even part of it. So it's actually, as high school students are forming driving behaviors and driving habits, one of the really interesting things and something they found really fascinating was that, you know, not gunning it when you get going and driving the speed limit, which is hard for some folks to do, or making sure to even just combine your errands so that instead of going out five times, you go on one trip to the grocery store and the laundromat and everything else. So talking about some of those sort of easy changes that actually make a big difference.
So, and this was in comparison to your control group, I suppose. They were doing more of a traditional experiment. So what was that experiment? I understand was putting shells into an acidic solution. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. So we call the control group the shells and acid group, because what they do is they take marine animal shells, oysters, clams. We put in some sand dollars because they also have calcium carbonate skeletons. And they basically stuck them in vinegar or carbonated water, which is a little less acidic. And they compared it to seawater. And basically what they see is when you stick shells in acid, it bubbles and they start to dissolve. And this implies that what's going to happen with ocean acidification is all of these animals are just going to totally dissolve in the ocean. And one thing that we were testing, in addition to doing a very common lab, the shells and acid lab, it's really common. I think of all the curriculum that we looked at while we were developing ours, yep, about half of it used that lab.
Ocean 103, mm-hmm, oceanography. Yep, we do that lab too.
Here at Oregon State, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually one of the original write-ups back in, I think it was 2008, for shells and acid came from the SMILE program here at Oregon State. So it's tangible. A lot of kids said, oh, that was a great lab, I really got it. The unfortunate thing is it conveys a misconception about what ocean acidification will mean. So it allowed us to test this misconception as well as provide a comparison group.
Right. I mean, because you're testing it on dead shells that, mm-hmm, don't have any way of responding.
Yeah. And we know that live animals can repair their shells. We know that they have a coating outside of their shells that basically keeps them from dissolving. Even animals called pteropods, these little tiny marine snails, they're often called the canaries in the coal mine for ocean acidification. A couple of papers came out this year that say, oh, it turns out they spend some extra time and fully repair their shells even when they're damaged from the outside. They sort of fix it from the inside. So we don't know what it will mean, but we do know that in 50 years, you're not going to walk to the beach and see no shells. You'll see animals that are still going. They might be smaller. There might be less of them. But that notion, the main conclusion from that lab that we used was sort of misleading.
Yeah, that makes me think of another interesting episode we did a while back with Grace Klingis. She's in microbiology, and she was looking at how corals and their microbiomes respond to different levels of CO2 in the water. So you can take her, check that out, episode.
Yeah, mm-hmm, that sounds exciting. I know there's, you know, I must admit that my development of this curriculum was Pacific Northwest focused, and I know there's a whole other body of ocean acidification research that looks at coral reefs, the microbes that live within coral, and responses to not only increasing temperature but changing chemistry as well. And trying to predict what will happen again is really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what did you find basically between the two different groups? How were they different at all?
Yeah. So still sorting through and trying to make sense of the results. But some of the preliminary findings, all of our students, regardless of the group, they learned from our instruction, which is a good thing. You hope that, you know, teaching kids for 4 days leads them to know more. The other thing that we saw in both groups was they felt like ocean acidification was happening. They weren't quite sure if it was happening in their bay, but they knew it was happening on the West Coast, and they knew it was happening globally after instruction. And so, you know, they knew what it was, they knew what caused it, and they knew that it was happening. We also measured things like how much control or concern do you feel like you have over this? Should you or should someone else be taking action? And what sorts of things could you be doing? And for our control group, none of those changed. So basically, learning about this environmental problem didn't make them more concerned. It didn't make them feel like they had any more control. It didn't make them feel like they or others should be doing anything more about it. And they didn't know what they could do. It's worth saying that they said they were fairly concerned, and they said that we should be doing something. So the fact that it didn't increase, you know, I'm not totally sure what that means right now. But the big question here, we were looking at if teaching students about solutions changes how they think at all. The solution students initially were more concerned, and they also expressed that we should be doing something about it. So it seemed like teaching about solutions made them feel more inclined to do something. We asked them 10 weeks later as well, and all of those changes disappeared.
Really?
So there's sort of this question of, okay, this immediate impact, we're really excited about what we just learned. And then the question of long-term impact, especially with sort of one-off education projects, what's our long-term impact, and will that really lead to a change in behavior?
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I wonder why sort of like why that is. Maybe they're just like focused on what they're learning at that time, you know. Just thinking back to, you know, my experience in high school.
Yeah, so a couple of our students, so we asked them to list things they could do, and then we gave them a big blank afterwards just to say anything else they felt like they needed to say. And on the follow-up surveys in particular, several of our students said, you know, I really liked learning about ocean acidification. I wish I could remember more. Or another one said, hey, I learned a lot, but, you know, in these last 10 weeks, I've sat in school every day, all day for 10 weeks, and I've had a lot more information come at me. It'd be really nice to be reminded about the things I learned 10 weeks ago. And I think that's a reminder to us that, yes, mm-hmm. we can learn something and we can even feel pretty confident about it. But unless we're reminded about it, it's going to fade because there's always a new thing that's coming up, either just on Instagram or in the news or, you know, in our daily lives. It's easy to right. forget when we've only heard about something once.
Well, I think in my experience in learning about teaching, it's really a common way to retain information and be able to retrieve that later is you need to revisit it mm-hmm. again and again and again at certain intervals. And so, I mean, I guess that's what, I mean, even your students were kind of reflecting on that and saying, yeah, you know, we talked about it then, but I didn't hear it again. And so that information just kind of floats away. Whereas if it's revisited periodically, maybe it would have more of an impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the challenges of doing an experiment where you, the researcher, jump into a classroom for 4 days and then you disappear. Mm-hmm. As a teacher, you plan out that progression so that you reinforce all those ideas that need remembering. You help with ongoing distinctions between ideas and you create a one or multi-year progression of learning. And yeah, exactly. So it would have been really great for me to say 5 weeks later, hey, remember when we talked about ocean acidification and how it connects to photosynthesis? We're talking about carbon dioxide today or climate change even, any of those other big ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to make sense, though, that you had the control group that really didn't name any sort of like responses about what they could do. Mm-hmm. And I guess that sort of makes sense because, you know, it's a global environmental phenomenon that we know little about. It's poorly constrained. And yeah, if you don't give them any, this is how you can help on a day-to-day sort of scale. You know, it's just kind of like mentally easy to curl up into a ball or something and just say, oh, this is too big for me to handle, even as, you know, as a high school student, especially, you know, just, what can I do really?
Yeah. And, you know, there's two things that we really struggled with there. One, when we looked at the details of what students were writing initially at the start of the surveys and 10 weeks after, our control group, they still came up with answers, but they weren't very specific for the most part. They dealt with cleaning up the beach, reducing litter, don't pollute, which either could have meant don't dump chemicals or don't burn fossil fuels. That's also pollution. So, you know, some of those ideas are they're spot on, but it's hard to tell what students were really meaning or if they could do something.
Yeah, like was it tied to the curriculum?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the other really interesting thing that came up a lot after learning about ocean acidification was students said, hey, we should drive less or walk more. And we're working with students who are out on the Oregon coast, and there's not a whole lot of public transportation. And the school district that we were working in covers quite a bit of area. So the notion of students driving less might not be all that doable. There's other things that get in the way of some of these really great ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, where do you hope that these findings from your research go?
So I think one thing is just to remember that education is certainly something that we need about ocean acidification. We need to talk about it more. The non-scientist public typically hasn't heard a whole lot about it yet, and so we could talk more about ocean acidification. I think the other thing to consider is we should probably start talking about solutions as well. I don't know if it's better to talk about things that we could do. Sort of my initial assumption was, hey, as a high school student, there's a whole lot outside of your control, so we should probably talk about things that could be within your control. But we need a lot of community action, state action, and things like that. So thinking about solutions in general. But the question was, where do I hope this would go? I hope that more teachers feel like there's one more resource they could use to teach about ocean acidification. I hope that they feel like there's an opportunity to talk about impacts and solutions in a more concrete way. And the state of Oregon's actually putting together an action plan right now on ocean acidification. We recently put together a council, and their first report's going to come out in September. So the education committee is thinking about, you know, what new education resources do we need? What else could be done? And I'm actually excited to go talk with them, I think, next month. So I don't know what will come of it. A lot of it is hoping to put another resource out there that teachers can use to start a conversation.
Yeah.
Great. Sounds like an exciting step forward. Mm-hmm. So if you're just tuning in, this is Inspiration Dissemination. This is KBVR Corvallis, 88.7 FM. We are interviewing with Brian Erickson. He's in marine resource management, just finishing up his master's. Is it this term?
Yeah, this term it should be.
Yeah, cool. talking about how the how students can learn about ocean acidification and how they perceive it and what will lead to more change based on that.
So we've talked quite a bit about your research, but I think it's time that we kind of talk about your journey and how you had a pretty eventful time between your undergraduate degree and coming to graduate school. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what all of the jobs you had and kind of how that led you here to Oregon State?
Yeah, it certainly has not been a direct path from the end of undergraduate to now what's actually my second master's, and I'll be starting a PhD in fish and wildlife this summer. So it certainly hasn't been a direct path. I think I recently counted and there's been something like 26 or 30 jobs in my life.
Wow.
Probably more than 20 of those have been since I graduated from undergrad at Lewis and Clark College. You know, I think it's part of that challenge of trying to figure out what I was really excited about and passionate about. I knew I loved the outdoors. I thought it was important to help others understand. And so a lot of my jobs have been between field biology work, outdoor education and adventure education, and classroom instruction. And it was really a lot of bouncing back and forth between short-term seasonal jobs, which is normal, and then also a couple of longer-term gigs as well, where I thought it was gonna be a new life path, and it just didn't quite turn out to be what I thought it was.
So you have an undergraduate degree in biology, is that right?
Biology from Lewis and Clark College,
okay. Yep. And then you went on to be a high school teacher.
Eventually, yeah. So I had a couple of different field jobs, did everything from banding seabirds in Hawaii and, you know.
You had a pretty formative experience in, right after your undergrad in the Caribbean, you were studying seaweed?
Oh, yeah. So that was actually my first summer of college.
Oh, okay.
After freshman year, I got to go to St. Croix, and then the next summer we went to Panama, and we basically studied the sexual reproduction of calcifying seaweeds for two summers and tried to figure out what was going on. And honestly, we didn't figure out very much, but it was a great time to fall in love with the ocean and spend two summers on coral reefs. And
yeah, definitely.
I definitely think that's part of the reason why I'm here today.
Sounds like a rough life.
Yeah, I know, right? I know.
And then so you got into teaching. How did that come about?
So I was actually out on an island with three other people and 20,000 birds and was sort of wondering how could my biology background impact more people. And I thought back to this program called Teach for America, and I thought it was a great way to sort of get into a classroom into what I thought would be a lifelong career in teaching. And so through Teach for America, I worked at a brand new high school in the Bronx in New York City and spent what turned out to only be 2 years, but spent a couple of years teaching high school biology.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty intense program that they put you through, right? I mean, it's just, you know, this is how to teach, now go teach.
Yeah, so you have about 6 weeks in the summer where you supposedly learn all you need to know about teaching, and then you're dropped in, and depending on your school and depending who else is there, you certainly have extra support throughout the way. I don't mean to imply that Teach for America just says good luck.
Yeah, right.
But you know, there's after this initial training, I was actually in graduate school while I was doing Teach for America, so they have you through a master's in teaching program. But it's intense. You're put into schools that really need dedicated and committed teachers, and it's not easy by any means.
So eventually you ended up here at OSU. So what made you choose to come to Oregon State?
So I was living up in Portland, and I wanted to stay somewhere on the West Coast. I grew up in the Midwest. I'd already spent time on the East Coast. I knew that I loved it here, and I wanted to stay somewhere on the West Coast. And I actually was talking with a whole bunch of different professors about programs and trying to find a good fit. And I talked to a good friend of the program director here, and she basically suggested, hey, why don't you look at the Marine Resource Management program? It sounds exactly like what you're looking for. It's a focus on sort of the social science, how people think and do marine resource management with a really strong science foundation. And once I talked to Flax and Conway, our program director, I knew that it was a place I wanted to be. And thankfully, we found some money as well to make it more reasonable to attend school here.
Yeah. And so you liked it so much that you're continuing on to a PhD right after this.
I just can't stop. So I'll be moving in and into the Fisheries and Wildlife Building and focusing a bit more on how people think about marine conservation and how considering different perspectives can hopefully help us be more successful in our conservation efforts.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple different traditions here that we do on inspiration dissemination. And one of them is to ask each of our guests every week, if you had a piece of advice you could give yourself, your prior self, or any undergraduates who may be listening and say, oh, graduate school sounds fun. You get to go and you get to like, you know, teach people or, you know, swim in the ocean and collect seaweed or whatever. And so do you have any sort of, I guess, formative advice that you would give someone?
I think one piece of advice, it's always hard to give advice because, you know, you kind of want to cater it to whoever you're talking to. If I were talking to myself 10 years ago, now I think it is at least, I would say, you know, it's okay to spend some time trying to figure out what you're interested in. You don't have to necessarily go right away. If you know, then go for it. You know, don't lose momentum. But if you're not sure, try some things out, see what you're really excited about. And now that I'm back and I feel like I've sort of dabbled in some different things, it makes it a lot easier to focus and it makes it a lot easier to sort of be okay being selfish and focusing on those true interests of mine.
Yeah. I think that's a great suggestion.
So the other tradition we have is for you to choose a song. So can you tell us the song you chose and why you decided to choose this song?
Yeah, so I chose a song called Elephant's Foot by Maceo Parker. I grew up, I started playing the alto saxophone in fourth grade, and I played all the way through college and beyond.
Wow.
And Elephant's Foot, I think it's just a really fun, goofy song. It certainly is not serious by any means. There's a little hint of teaching in there as well, which I think is funny, but mostly I think
I missed it. I'll have to look for it.
So there's a teaching reference in here, but okay. Mostly it's just a funny song that is pretty funky and I would play along with sometimes while I was hanging out.
Cool. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. I have definitely learned a lot about your research, and I'm always interested in hearing about people's journeys and how they got here. So yeah, thank you.
Very cool. Well,
thanks for having me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Elephant's Foot by Maceo Parker.